When wishes were horses and beggars could ride, in a stone castle by the sea there lived a rich laird.
What am I supposed to choose? There are so many.
And so he left the trail, and he followed the sound of the music.
I am the goat from the hills and the mountains. And when I have finished eating these herbs and these vegetables, then I shall eat you, too.
Once upon a time, and welcome to the Story Story Podcast. I am today's part-time host, Simon Brooks, and I have some great stories for you this episode. This is a podcast to hear traditional stories told by some of the best storytellers in the world. It will take you to long ago and far away, and bring you back safely. My parents got divorced when I was 6 and my brother was 4. My dad moved to Swansea in South Wales from Worcester in the West Midlands. So me and my brother would go and holiday there to spend time with dad. At the time of this tale, he lived in an old vicarage which overlooked a graveyard. It was an old stone house with a large fireplace in the living room and an Arga stove in the kitchen and very little else in the way of heat. It is beautiful in South Wales, especially Gower, near where Dad lived. Gower is its own peninsula, with beaches, coves, blowholes and caves, with a lot of tea rooms and ice cream shops, with old ladies with blue rinse hair serving you. At least they did back then. One of the caves my brother and I liked to visit could only be reached at low tide, or by a boat, or by a rope, and climbing either up or down to it. It's called Culver Hole, and was thought to be a smuggler's cave, but it is a dovecote, a home for doves and pigeons. The cave, or dovecote, was built into the cliffside, walled up with a series of windows and doorways. Inside were hundreds of letterboxes, as it were, which were thought to be where smugglers kept their bottles of rum, my hearties, yes. But they were pigeonholes. In the Middle Ages and up to the 18th century, pigeons were cheap and quick red meat when looked after and fed. There are stories about tunnels linking the cave to other parts of Gower, and lots of stories of ghosts and pirates. Culver Hole is now a site of special scientific interest, one of those SSSIs, and is a scheduled ancient monument. But when I was a kid, it was hidden from most and a crazy secret hangout for those in the know. My brother and I were in the know, thanks to Dad. One week in early June, Colin and I were visiting Dad in Swansea. He drove us around in his yellow Ford Escort station wagon, his estate, to see some castles and old ruins around the coast, ancient stone salt sheds and Culver Hole. It was nice and hot, so we were in shorts, but not so hot that our legs got stuck to the vinyl seats. Dad played the Moody Blues and Deep Purple on the cassette machine in the car. Visiting castles and haunted ruins was gold to us at 10 and 12 years of age. We would get to climb over the ruins, clamber into caves, and stand on the top of cliffs. On days when the wind blew hard against the cliffs, we would throw grass over the edge, and it would blow back to us and up into the air, sometimes flying way over our heads. We had walked along the top part of the cliffs around Port Einion and had a very late picnic lunch. We had cheese and Branston pickles sandwiches and cheese and onion crisps, or potato chips as you call them here in the States. Dad was lying down on the picnic blanket enjoying the warmth and fell asleep with his flat cap over his face. My brother and I, mostly me I think, were known to wear people out, and my dad was no exception. Colin and I took our chance. We had looked down over the cliff edge before the picnic and knew the tide was up, but Colin and I had heard there was a rope we could use to climb down. We ran to the spot where we were hoping to find the rope. It wasn't one rope, but half a dozen, all wrapped around each other, some newer than others, some frayed. I was the one to go down first. Here's the thing about climbing down a rope. You have to climb back up. At ages 10 and 12, we were not very strong in our upper body, but we didn't think about this. Colin waited as I slowly lowered myself, hand over hand, sometimes scrambling over the rock's surface, sometimes dangling free over a 70-foot drop to the cliffs below. It didn't seem to take long to get to the upper edge of the wall and at the top entrance of the cave. I called up to Colin to follow me down, and I would hold on to the rope to stop it from swinging about so much. It was then that I heard a moan, a deep, low groan that echoed from the cave. It seems my true fairy tale is just right for this, our first storyteller, Stuart Stotts, who is telling the story of Arthur Lancelot and Guinevere. I have not heard Stuart tell stories before this, but this episode, or part of Arthur's life, is well captured. I was transported to some of the places I visited that carry King Arthur's name in the UK. Stuart lives in DeForest, Wisconsin, with his wife Heather Terrell Stotts, telling stories, singing songs, and playing music all over the world. I hope you enjoy this retelling from the courts of King Arthur.
Guinevere and Lancelot walked in the garden of the abbey where Guinevere had lived ever since King Arthur was mortally wounded at the Battle of Camlann and taken away to the land of Avalon. The two walked side by side. It would be the last time the two lovers would meet in this lifetime. But as they walked, their history unfolded before them like a medieval tapestry, rich and full of story. Guinevere's father had been an ally of King Arthur's, but her marriage was not simply a matter of political expediency. Arthur was young, handsome, brave, and strong, and dedicated to bringing England together under one ruler. Arthur ruled in Camelot. Guinevere sat at his side, loving him as a queen and as his wife. Sir Lancelot had been raised by the Lady of the Lake, taught the skills that a knight needed to know, how to wield a sword, how to set a spear, how to ride, how to give mercy. He was taught the courtesies and courtly manners that a knight needed to know as well. And when he arrived at Camelot, he was soon acknowledged to be the greatest knight of the Company of the Round Table. But his greatest strength was his loyalty to his lord, King Arthur. Together, they fought many battles, subduing villains and bringing peace and order to England. In those days, knights of the Round Table would often become the champion for a lady of the court, and Lancelot became Guinevere's champion. He would wear a ribbon or a scarf or a ring as a token of her favor when he fought a duel or in a jousting tournament or in battle. But after a while, it wasn't enough to be her champion. The two of them fell in love with each other, and they were torn between their loyalty to King Arthur and the overwhelming passion they felt for each other. On a number of occasions, Lancelot rescued Guinevere. Once she was held by a knight in a castle, and the only way to get into the castle was to crawl across a bridge constructed of upturned swords. Lancelot did just that, slicing the skin on his hands and his feet in order to save her. Another time, he was in pursuit of someone who had kidnapped her. His horse was killed from under him, and Lancelot followed her, riding in a cart. Although that was considered ignoble for a knight, Lancelot didn't care. All he wanted to do was to make the greatest haste possible in order to save Guinevere. But each time Lancelot rescued her, he always returned her to her husband, King Arthur. For 9 years, Lancelot and Guinevere were lovers, meeting when they could, but the other members of the court soon became suspicious. They saw the lingering gazes, the whispered conversations. Their love affair was a secret only to King Arthur. Eventually, Lancelot and Guinevere's love was revealed to King Arthur by members of the court. Lancelot was forced to flee Camelot, and Guinevere was sentenced to burn for her treason. But before she could be dragged to the fire, Lancelot returned with his knights, saved her, took her to his castle. It was the beginning of the end of the golden era of the Round Table. Former comrades took up arms against each other, took sides against each other. Plotting and treachery became the order of the day. King Arthur besieged Lancelot in his castle. After a battle, Lancelot and Arthur made peace. The terms of the truce between them meant that Guinevere would return to King Arthur. Lancelot went to France, but King Arthur returned to Camelot to face the treachery of his nephew, Sir Mordred, who aspired to be king. They fought a battle, and though King Arthur killed Sir Mordred, he also received a mortal blow. As Arthur lay dying, he asked that his sword Excalibur be thrown into the lake, and when that was accomplished, the ladies of the lake came in a barge and carried him off to the mystic land of Avalon, from whence he may someday return to unify and bring peace to England once again. After the battle, Guinevere made her way to the abbey at Almesbury. She dedicated her life to prayer and service. Lancelot had tried to get back to England from France in time to help King Arthur, but he was too late. He heard where Guinevere had gone and went to visit her at the abbey. Guinevere and Lancelot walked through the garden together, through the flowers and the herbs. Birds were singing in the trees, and their memories shone between them. Memories of Camelot, the glory days, the tournaments, the feasts, the celebration, the jousts, the pageantry, and their hours of passion and their days of deceit. The knights Lancelot lay alone, wishing. The knights Guinevere lay weeping next to King Arthur, who slept unaware. As time came for him to leave, Lancelot fell to the feet of Guinevere. Tears streaming from his eyes, he begged for her forgiveness, for the pain, for the passion that he could not overcome, but she lifted him up. Tears flowed from her eyes as well. She asked for his forgiveness, and they gazed deeply into each other's souls in a clear-eyed moment of mutual absolution. "You must not come again," she said, and Lancelot felt his heart break like the cracking of a crystal goblet. Lancelot took Guinevere's face in his hands, kissed her on the forehead, and turned to leave. He looked back one time from the gate and saw Guinevere sitting on the bench, the slanted light of afternoon on her face as the shadows lengthened. Lancelot took up residence at a hermitage near Glastonbury and dedicated his life to prayer and atoning for the evil things he had done. For many years, he lived there, joined sometimes by former knights of the Round Table. But one night, he had a dream, a vision in which Guinevere called to him. The next morning, he got on his horse. He rode as quickly as he could to Almesbury, but arrived too late. Guinevere had died only an hour before he arrived. He brought her body to Glastonbury, buried her in a marble coffin, sang the funeral service over her, and lowered her into the ground in a place that no one knows now. But Lancelot did not live long himself. Within a few weeks, he felt himself growing weak, and one night he passed away in his sleep. His brother, Sir Hector, stood over Lancelot's body, holding his sword and his shield. He said, "Ah, Lancelot, there you lie. I dare say you were never matched by any earthly knight's hands. You are the most courteous knight that ever bore a shield, the truest friend to thy lover, the truest lover of a sinful man that ever loved woman, and you are the kindest man that ever struck with sword, the goodliest person that ever came among the press of knights. You are the meekest and the gentlest that ever ate in the hall among ladies, and you are the sternest knight to your mortal foe that ever put spear in rest." Lancelot was buried in a place that no one remembers. Let the singers sing and the poets tell how a kingdom rose and a kingdom fell, how love ran cold and love ran hot in the halls of Camelot. Say their names and shed a tear for Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere.
Gingerbread, Edible Homes, Deconstruction Company, tra-la-la, tra-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la. Always have a roof over your head and food at the ready. Granny Smith has used her baking skills to create charming homes made from gingerbread spice and sugar icing. Sugar windows of all colours and sizes can be incorporated into your forever home. Granny also makes custom windows, doors, and even locks and window latches. Using all natural ingredients, organic options also available, tempering all construction materials with non-chemical products makes your home not only beautiful and edible, but also earth-friendly. Call Granny Smith and the Gingerbread Edible Homes Deconstruction Company now and get free samples along with design suggestions. Call now and she will also throw in a minted hearth. Not only that, for the value of an additional outhouse, Granny Smith will also throw in... A big shout out to all of you who have become patrons over the years, but this week, a special shout out to Tara Tayyab Khan. I hope I pronounced that right. Thanks, Tara, for joining the ever-expanding gang who support this great podcast. Woot, woot! The groan turned into a moan. Then the moan turned into some sort of longing call. I looked up. Colin was on the ropes. I could feel the rope moving and see him trying to hold on tight. I wanted to call up and tell him to stop and that I was coming back up. But what if whatever it was in there was hungry? Or it was a ghost? If I called out, whatever it was might get me. There was the sound again. I held tightly to the rope and bit my bottom lip. Colin was getting closer, but he was taking his time. I rolled my head back and breathed deeply, closing my eyes. I decided to look into the darkness below. I leaned on the rope, the top half of my body leaning into the empty space of the cave, my sneakers barely holding on to the stone wall. And pointing my head down, I opened my eyes, hoping the monster would not be looking up. It was not a monster. It was a human being, a woman or so I thought at first. I saw a seal next to the woman, who stood shaking her hair, turning slowly, her hands, fingers spreading out. She was about 30 feet below and in shadow. The smell of the sea and fish rose to meet my nose. The seal called out again. That was the noise I had heard. But... The seal began to roll about, and it left its skin on the pebble floor of the cave. And there was another woman, who stood and moved about. Another three seals came into the cave, swimming in on the sea waves, breaking against the stone wall, built there some 700 or 800 years ago. These were not seals, nor humans, but the Selkie people. I was startled by Colin's sneakers hitting my hand and nearly let go of the rope. I was able to put my fingers to my lips and gesture to him to be quiet. I helped Colin to the top of the walls, and holding onto the rope, we sat on the stone, looking down, barely breathing. The Selkie people began to sing and dance together. I was mesmerized. I had read stories about the seal people and had heard tales of the Selkies, but to see them was something else. Their songs were haunting, and their dance slow but so, so beautiful. Sometimes their hands would join, sometimes only the very tips of their fingers would touch. They would move in a way seaweed moves in a slow swell, like fish move in the ocean. I'm not sure how long we watched for before we heard Dad calling. I'm not sure if it were Colin or I who knocked the small rock free from the wall, startled by the voice of our father. But the Selkies looked up and saw our dangling feet. Before we could count to 10, they were all in their sealskins and in the water, diving out through the bottom door hole. We called up to Dad that we were okay and inside Culver Hole, and coming up. Colin went up first. He was in the best position, and I didn't mind sitting and waiting, as I knew we would be in big trouble. And besides, there was one girl seal person who was looking up at me smiling, her long red hair waving goodbye as she put on her sealskin and dove into the Bristol Channel to swim out to the Celtic Sea. I met Julie Moss years ago. She is a delightful person, a wonderful person, and a fun storyteller. She wrote a book on Chinese folk and fairy tales, which she herself collected whilst travelling around China. Very cool, and I have to say, I'm a little bit jealous. Please enjoy her wonderful telling of Butterfly Lovers.
The Butterfly Lovers. Zhu Yingtai was the only daughter of the prosperous Zhu family. She was rather rambunctious instead of the predictable, proper young lady of a well-to-do family because she had only brothers as role models. She also desperately wanted to obtain an education, which of course was out of the question for a young woman in old China. She listened outside the door while the tutor taught her brothers, and she copied the characters they drew. So she did know how to read and write. Yingtai thought, I must plan a way to acquire my education. She cut her hair in the manner of a proper young man and dressed in her brother's clothing. In order to discover if her disguise would work, she contrived to meet her father away from the home. In 2 hours' time with her father, she was able to convince him she was a young man. She asked questions about his business and soaked up his answers like a sponge. When she finally revealed who she was, her father was shocked and amazed. She had been so convincing that when she pleaded with her parents, please, please allow me to obtain an education so I may help you with your business. Her parents reluctantly agreed to allow her to travel to Hangzhou to study with Master Zhao at his boarding school. She would have to remain in disguise as a young man the whole time while she studied. To reach Hangzhou, Yingtai had to walk a long way. On the road, she met a young man, Liang Shanbo, who was also on his way to the school of Master Zhao. Shanbo told her, my family is very poor, but I was able to obtain a scholarship to study with Master Zhao. It is an honor for one such as I to be allowed to study. Yingtai replied, it does not matter to me that your family is poor. Perhaps we can travel together and pass the time by talking. Liang Shanbo and Zhu Yingtai became good friends on their journey. Although Yingtai hid her identity well, she soon began to fall in love with Shanbo. She thought, oh, I can never reveal myself, or I will immediately be dismissed from school. So she contented herself with friendship, which soon developed into the closeness of brothers. The two friends went to classes together, studied together, ate together, walked together, and talked about many things as they became closer. Yingtai was sad that she could not reveal her true identity. One day, Yingtai received a letter from her father, which explained, your mother is gravely ill, and you are needed at home at once. She showed the letter to Chambeau as she was packing her few belongings. He felt very sorry for her and said, "You should not have to go home alone. I will travel with you at least part of the way." Ying Tae was grateful for his company and thought, perhaps I can tell him who I really am on the way home. As they walked along, Ying Tae thought, I will subtly tell him I am a girl. When they paused by a lake, she pointed out two mandarin ducks, which in China are the symbol of lovers. "Look, look, two ducks, just like us." "No, we are brothers, not lovers." Further along, they stopped under a lotus tree. Looking up, Ying Tae saw two blossoms growing very close together from one stem. "Look, two lotus blossoms, just like us." "No, we are brothers, not lovers." Still further along, while walking through a field, Ying Tae saw two doves flying together. "Look, two doves, just like us." "No, we are brothers, not lovers." He just did not seem to understand what she was trying to explain. Finally, exasperated, Ying Tae said, "You know, Chambeau, I have a sister of marriageable age. Would you like to meet her?" "Oh, if she's half as nice as you, her brother, it would be the best marriage possible. And then we really would be brothers." Now Ying Tae, in her role as a young man of the family, was entitled to arrange a marriage for her sister. So Ying Tae invited Chambeau to come all the way home with her, which pleased him greatly. When they reached Ying Tae's home, Chambeau was invited to spend the night. The next morning, he met Ying Tae's sister and thought, "She is as wonderful as my friend and very beautiful." He fell in love. Ying Tae, dressed as her sister, felt her heart leap for joy. Her joy was short-lived, for after Chambeau left, Ying Tae's mother revealed, "I am not really ill." The letter, it had been a ruse to get Ying Tae home so she could be wed to a rich man her father knew through his business, a marriage which her parents had arranged for her. Since Chambeau, the love of her life, was from a poor family, Ying Tae knew her parents would never agree to a marriage between them. She was very sad. When Chambeau next came to visit, Ying Tae, as her sister, had to tell him, "I cannot see you again." It broke her heart to say that, but there was nothing else she could do. She could not explain everything that was happening. Chambeau was very upset. He had hoped for a bride, but now he was turned away. He became very depressed thinking of his situation as he made his way back to school. He missed his friend and had no one to whom he could talk. He could not study. He could not eat. He just sat in his room, missing his brother more than ever. And he wondered why the sister had turned him away when he had hoped to make her his bride. Things became so bad, Chambeau decided he had nothing to live for. He died of a broken heart. As was the custom in old China, Liang Chambeau's tomb was set on a hillside near a lovely little stream with trees growing nearby to ensure good feng shui. This was near Ying Tae's town. When she heard the news, Ying Te cried every day whenever she was alone. There was nothing else she could do until she started planning again. She told her parents, "I am placing three conditions on going through with this marriage. One, I must be allowed to wear white beneath my bright red wedding gown. Two, I must be allowed to take the road which leads by Shambo's tomb on my way to my wedding at my new husband's home. Three, I must be allowed to stop at Shambo's tomb to pay my respects to my old friend." Although her parents were not happy about consenting to her conditions, they agreed, because otherwise she refused to go through with the marriage. This would never do, as the family would then lose face. The day of her wedding came. Ying Te dressed very carefully. She wore a white gown, the color of mourning in China, under her exquisite bright red wedding gown. The bearers hoisted her sedan chair onto their shoulders and set off down the road to Shambo's tomb. Her chair was set down. Carefully, she alighted and made her way to the tomb. There, she removed the red gown to reveal her beautiful white dress. She placed flowers at the tomb, fell to her knees, and began to weep. She cried for a long time. While she was weeping, thunderclouds gathered. Rain poured down. Thunder crashed. Lightning lit the sky. A bolt of lightning struck Shambo's tomb. It split open. Instantly, Ying Te made a decision. She threw herself into the open tomb. The tomb suddenly closed. Ying Te and Shambo were together. The stunned wedding party stood there and gasped in horror. They could not believe their eyes. The bride was gone, and there was absolutely nothing they could do except go explain to the rich man who was to have been her husband. However, no one wanted to do that. So they stayed by the tomb. When the rain stopped and the sun reappeared, everything seemed clean and fresh. As they watched, two beautiful butterflies flew from a hole in the top of the sealed tomb. Shambo and Ying Te, together forever.
Thank you for listening to the Story Story podcast. Show your love and find Stuart and Julie's websites. Stuart can be found at stuartstotts.com. That's StuartStotts.com. And Julie's work can be found at storiesbyjulie.com. Spend some money on these sites and on Rachel Ann's site. Most performers have lost all their income right now, and every little bit counts. You can find Rachel Ann and the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Story Story Podcast or Rachel Ann Harding. There you will find the visual candy from the fairy tale sponsor ads and other goodies. I'm on Instagram at Simon M. Brooks and on Facebook on my website, SimonBrooksStoryteller.com. Diamond Scree? Yep, that's me. The beautiful brains behind the fairy tale sponsor belong to Alexis Cooley. The inspiration for the true fairy tale come from a memory of mine triggered by cracks in the wall, wouldn't you know? Check out the ads for the fairy tale sponsors. They are a lot of fun, and Rachel Ann puts a lot of time and effort into them. And let me and Aunt Isabel know a favourite story you have heard, or the favourite stories of your childhood. Tell us what they are. Who knows? Maybe we can record them for you. Think about that. Send a request. This podcast is made possible by patrons like you, by patrons like Tara. We thank you. For those of you who have become patrons, to Rachel Ann, thanks. You make the world a better place. If you would like to become a supporter of the podcast or discover real sponsorship opportunities, you can find links on storystorypodcast.com. If it isn't in the cards right now to support the podcast right now, no worries right now. Perhaps you would be willing to go and write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you found this podcast, which helps others and story lovers find and enjoy this podcast. What will you get if you become a Patreon supporter? Head over to the website and join the mailing list for hidden goodies. And when you tune in next, you'll hear more stories next week. But until then, live happily and lovingly ever after. Bye.
Mary-Kate opened up the door, and there, on the doorstep, wrapped in his own blanket, was her baby.
And to this day, Anansi spins webs so that he can catch the flea, the fly, and the moth that got away.
If you go down to the lake on a clear day, when the water lies as calm as a sheet of glass, you can still see the rooftops of the castle glittering in the sunlight. And if you listen really closely, you can even hear the festive music from the roof.